And we're holding on page 26 in Gittin, the middle of Oislamenfes, about the middle of page 26. We started talking yesterday about the whole matter of writing parts of Tanakh, parts of books rather than a whole book of Tanakh, and we said that's really not allowed, but eventually in certain cases they were mutter it because of Eis L'Asas L'Hashem, and similarly writing down Torah Shebaal Peh also gradually became mutter for the same reason. There is an interesting idea, by the way. It's brought that Rav Nosson Adler, one of the Rebbeim of the Chassam Sofer, didn't write down any of his Chidushim. And they asked him why, and he said, because since the whole heter was in case you might forget, he said, I have an excellent memory, so therefore I have no heter to write it down. The result is, actually, unfortunately, we have very little of his Torah. We have scattered things that the Chassam Sofer and other Talmudim of his recorded, but not a whole lot. Anyway, so continuing on this topic of the writing of Torah Shebichsav versus Torah Shebaal Peh, the Gemara says, Omer Rav Elazar, Torah Ruba Bichsav Mi'ulta Al Peh. The majority of the Torah is written down, and very little of it is Al Peh. Now, what does that mean? On the face of it, to him, we can see we have libraries upon libraries of Torah Shebaal Peh, and Torah Shebichsav is Sach Hakol 24 Sfarim. But Rashi explains, because we mean, for example, that things that come from Darshan and Psukim, Klal Prat, Gzeira Shava, and so on and so forth, those can all be considered part of Torah Shebichsav in the sense they all are based on something that it says in a pasuk. So once you put all that together, then you have a majority of the halachas depend on Torah Shebichsav, and only a miut is completely al peh, is completely halacha l'moshe Sinai without any derivation from the pasuk at all. Shenema, and Rabbi Loza says, you have a pasuk. Echtav loy ruve teirosi, I would write down for the Jewish people most of my Torah, k'moy zor nachshavu, and it seems to them like a stranger. In other words, the Navi is criticizing the Jewish people and saying, here, I wrote down most of what you need to learn is available to you from the psukim, and yet you're considering it foreign and saying we can't be bothered to learn it. So that's Rav Elazar. Rav Yochanan, I'm a Rav Al Peh, Umiyot B'Ksav. Whereas Rav Yochanan says most of the Torah is Torah Shebaal Peh, and only very little of it is Torah Shebichsav. Now, what does that mean then in that case? I mean, given Rav Elazar's definition, how could Rav Yochanan argue with that? And Maharsha asks that question. So he says that maybe in that case, maybe Torah Shebaal Peh, according to Rav Yochanan's definition, would be, according to Rashi's understanding of Rav Yochanan, you would have to say that Rashi would understand that you have what the Chachamim were Mechadish in every generation. In that case, once you add all that material together, meaning it's not necessarily Daushin with one of the Yud Gil Midas, but new ideas, new understandings of Torah that every Chacham comes up with in his own generation, once you add all that together, then yeah, you have a great deal more material than what you have in just the Psukim and the Yud Gil Midas. But then Maharsha says that Rabbi Yochanan may well say that things that are learned with the Yud Gimel Midas themselves can be considered part of Torah Shebaal Peh. In the sense that, for example, the Gemara mentions in a number of places, a person cannot come up with Gzeira Shava on his own. So therefore, anything learned by Gzeira Shava, Rabbi Elazar would consider it part of Torah Shebichsav, as Rashi is saying, because after all, it is based on words and psukim. But Rabbi Yochanan would redefine and say, no, that's part of Torah Shebaal Peh, in the sense that you can't come up with that Gzeira Shava unless you learned it from your Rebbe, who learned it from his Rebbe, etc., back to Moshe Rabbeinu at Har Sinai. So therefore, that could be called part of Torah Shebaal Peh. There is, by the way, in Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos elsewhere in Shas, what about the other midas? A kavachomer, the Gemara establishes in a number of places, a person can come up with a kavachomer on his own. It's just a logical thing. So fine, you can propound a kavachomer. If the other chachamim find reason to slug it up, then good. If not, then not. A gzeira shava, it's clear. The Gemara says you can't darshan on your own. You have to have the Kabbalah. What about the other midas? What about klalo prat? What about dabashoy v'chlal v'yotzim and a klalo lamed? What about all the other ones that we say in the Braisa of Rabbi Shmuel? Rashi and Tosfos argue elsewhere, can a person come up with those on his own and that would be valid, or do those also have to be something that he learned from his Rebbe? Anyway, the point is, so it would be a matter of definition then, what's considered Torah Shebichsav and what's considered Torah Shebaal Peh. And Rabbi Yochanan says, I also have a pasuk to prove my point. Ki api advorim ha'ela. Hashem says to Moshe, because it's on the mouth of these words, meaning the words of Torah Shebaal Peh that are said by the mouth, that Hashem made a covenant with the Jewish people. So we see that the primary part of Torah, therefore, is Torah Shebaal Peh, and therefore, Rabbi Yochanan says, it's not only the most important part, as far as that goes, it's also the majority of it. So the Gemara says, the idoch nami yoksiv echtov le rubi terosi. So what is Rabbi Yochanan doing with Rabbi Elazar's pasuk that implies that the majority of Torah is written down? And the answer is, that's not a statement. According to Rabbi Yochanan, he would read it as a rhetorical question. Hahu asmui kamasma. Hashem is asking like a rhetorical question. Echtov le rubi terosi. How could I write down for them the majority of my Torah? As it is, the part that I did write down for them, they consider foreign and they don't want to bother learning it. So in other words, Hashem, so it's not like Rabbi Elazar was saying that the statement, I wrote down for them the majority of the Torah, but rather, why would I write down the majority of the Torah in Torah Shabbat when even the little that there is, they find too burdensome? What does Rabbi Elazar do with Rabbi Yochanan's pasuk that ki al pi advarim ha'ela, which implies that Torah Shebaal Peh is greater in scope than Torah Shebaal? And the answer is ahum mishum detekifil migmirinu. The answer is no. It doesn't mean that there's more of it according to Rabbi Elazar, but it means it's much more difficult to learn because since it's Baal Peh, you have to really learn and you have to keep on reviewing it. Otherwise, you're going to end up forgetting it. Those are the two different opinions. Which one is bigger and which one is lesser? Continuing on this topic of Torah Shabbat versus Torah Shabbat, the Gemara says, Dorash Rabbi Yehuda ben Achmeni, Meturgemone de Rav Shimon Lakish. Rabbi Yehuda ben Achmeni, who was the Meturgemon of Rish Lakish, gave the following Dorasha. As we have throughout Shas, a Chacham would give a Dorasha, he wouldn't announce it loud for all the public to hear, instead he would say it relatively quietly to his Meturgemon, who then would amplify it and explain it and then say it loudly for everybody who was there. So sometimes these Meturgemonim were just, they had a loud voice here. The Rabbi Yehuda ben Achmeni himself was a Talmid Chacham, and we have things quoted from him in various places in Shas. Anyway, Shiv Ksav Lecha Es Advarim Eila. First, Hashem tells Moshe, write down these words. So implying that Hashem is telling him to write down the Torah, but then Hashem says, because on the mouth of these words, implying that it has to be kept by mouth and not written down. So what does it mean? There are, in fact, two different parts of Torah. Things that are written down, Torah Shebichsav, you're not allowed to say them Baal Peh. Now, you do have, the posts can discuss a number of exceptions to that. For example, people say Krishma by heart. People say other psukim. Some people say Tillim by heart, for example. There's a variety of different explanations that Mephoshim and the posts can give when it's mutter and when not. Because after all, to write Torah Shebaal Peh, we're saying eventually that had to be mutter because Eis Lasis Lashem. But on the face of it, that doesn't explain to us why you should be able to say Torah Shebaal Peh by heart. So there are a number of different answers. One of them is maybe it only applies when you're being motzi the tzibur, and in that case, then fine. You want to say Shema or Tillim or what have you for yourself, then it's not a problem. Another possibility is that it doesn't apply to psukim that people are very familiar with, again, such as Krishma. But on the whole, though, when you're saying Torah Shebichsav, it's supposed to be from a written text. And things that are Baal Peh, you can't learn from a written text. The Rambam, by the way, mentions, based on various scattered statements in the Gemara here and there, the Chachamim were allowed to, even back before Torah Shebaal Peh was allowed to be written, the Chachamim were allowed to write themselves private notes so that they wouldn't forget something that they had a chiddush that they had learned. They just weren't allowed to go and learn and teach from them to other people. They had to be kept private for themselves, which is why Rabbi Yehuda ben Achmeni is using the expression over here, la'omram b'ksav, to say them in writing. You can't have a written text in front of you and be saying and telling it over to other people from that. So then, the only reason, again, why the Gemara and the rest of Torah Shebaal Peh was written down was because it was being forgotten. Actually, Maor Shor points out, you don't really have that these psukim show that there is a Torah Shebaal Peh, and they show that there's a Torah Shebaal Peh. Where do you really see from it that each part has its own rules, and what's written can't be said by heart and vice versa? So Maor Shor says, because it says ha'ela. Because it says ha'ela, these is a miut, meaning these have to be this way and not the other ones. Dvei Rabbi Shmuel Tana and in the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they learned similarly. Ela, that was exactly that. When the pasuk says ela, these means ela after kosev, you can only write these words of the Torah that Hashem gave, v'yata kosev halachas, but you're not allowed to write down the halachas. Those are supposed to be part of Torah Shebaal Peh. And the Gemara continues, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, like Koras HaKadosh Baruch Hu bris in Yisrael, ela b'shvil dvarim Shebaal Peh. The reason Hashem made the bris, the covenant with the Jewish people, only because of the part of Torah that is Baal Peh. Shenema, because Hashem tells him, Ki al pi advarim ha'ela, on the mouth of these words, Karati itcha bris, I've made a covenant with you, ve'es Yisrael, and with the Jewish people. So we see that it's primarily Torah Shebaal Peh, that's the subject of the bris. So why is that? So here, we started touching on yesterday the reason why did Hashem plan in the first place that there should be a Torah Shebaal Peh? Why didn't Hashem just give everything in writing? So we talked about yesterday, first of all, an idea that the Chidah says that the very fact in those times that people had to review it over and over again so they don't forget, that itself was that itself refined their bodies, so they became much greater people compared to the later generations. In fact, the Chidah says that's once, for example, once the Mishnah was written, you didn't need to put as much effort into memorizing it. Then, therefore, people are on a lower level, and that's why he says that's why after that you have the period of the Amudoyim who are on a lower level than the Tanoim, and he says. Similarly, you have from one period to the next in Jewish history, so he doesn't elaborate what he means, but Bepashtus, again, you have the idea that more and more the Torah is systematized and written down and made into something that's much easier to get a handle on, and therefore less and less effort is needed to memorize it, and therefore that makes the generations go lower and lower. What the Chidah would say if he was around now to see Rabbi Google, I don't know. Anyway, there's a lot of other points in it. So Marsha points out that, again, exactly that, Torah Shebaal Peh, if you don't review it over and over, then you're going to forget it. So therefore, Hashem wants that you should put your mind to it to work on remembering it. There's also a point, the Smeh, the Sefer Me'ir HaSeinayim, makes a point in his introduction to his Pirush on Shulchan Aruch. The Smeh lived at the time, he was an early Achron, Rabbi Yeshua Falik Katz was his real name. He was a Rav in the late 15, early 1600s. In his times, the Shulchan Aruch was published and it started to become popular as a handbook of halacha. Nowadays, we don't exactly think of it as a handbook now that it has all the Noisa Kalim on it, but in origin, it was meant to be like a brief re-summarization of the halacha for the average person. Many Jewish Yisrael at that time were not really happy with the idea because then it's going to be like learning directly from the Mishnah. You're going to learn the halachas without understanding the actual application, when it applies, when it doesn't, the reasons behind it, and so forth, and you're going to misapply the halacha. So the Smeh was one of those opponents, but eventually, he writes in his Akdama, eventually he saw, listen, people are using the Shulchan Aruch, so then we have no choice, let's at least write a Pirush to explain, to give all that missing background that the Shulchan Aruch doesn't have. So he started writing on Choshen Mishpat, and he wrote on the Tur, and then he wrote on Choshen Mishpat, and he didn't live to complete anymore. Anyway, he writes in his Akdama, he says, I'll give you an example why it was much better when we had Torah, when that Torah Shebaal Peh was in fact Baal Peh. He says, consider, for example, he says, right now in our yeshiva, he says, when I'm writing this introduction, we happen to be learning Hilchos Lulav. Now you have, when it comes to the Lulav, you have to wave it. But how do you wave it, when it says you have to wave it three times in each direction, what does that mean? So you have three different Rishonim, you have a Yerushalmi that says you have to wave it three times in each direction, and then you have three different Rishonim, the Rif and two others, who argue what the Yerushalmi means, and then within the Rif's opinion itself, you have three later Rishonim who argue what the Rif meant, and so on and so forth, and he says, and here you have, this is, so on the face of it, such a simple, straightforward halacha, and you have it generate so much discussion of what exactly it means that you have to wave the lulav in each direction. The more complicated topics of Torah. So he says that's the idea. When Torah was Baal Peh, you wouldn't have that kind of uncertainty. You would ask your Rebbe face to face, what do you mean? And he would explain to you, and then you'd have it clear. So whereas when it's written down, you always have that inherent uncertainty because it's impossible to write things in a way that's going to be perfectly clear for all the generations to come. So that's one reason why Torah Shebaal Peh was originally meant to be Baal Peh, and they only had to write it down because there was no choice, it was being forgotten. Then the Maharal makes a point, he says like this, each part of the Torah has to have its own kind of shleimus. So you have, Torah Shebichtav is shalom in the sense it's a complete thing. Everything that had to be written down is written down in it. But on the other hand, you can't have, it would be impossible to have a written thing that covers every possible scenario and every possible circumstance and everything. In fact, in Eruvin, the Gemara talks about metaphorically how large Torah Shebaal Peh is and describes it as a scroll that's larger than the entire world. So the Eberstein instead gave us a Torah Shebaal Peh, which is perfect in a different way. Namely, it's given over to people's minds to go and analyze and understand and delve into it. And that way it's perfect in its own way that it's able to be used to cover every possible scenario. Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch, by the way, gives an interesting analogy. He says to compare what Torah, the relationship between Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Peh. He says, like, if you go to a lecture, you know, if you go to a lecture or a shiur or something, and you have notes, they give shiur notes and they give lecture notes with summary, with bullet points of what was talked about. But if you just read the bullet points by themselves, you're not going to get very much of what was being talked about. You'll get a general idea of it, but not more than that. You need to listen to an actual transcript or an actual recording of the shiur itself to know it fully. He says that's the same thing. Torah Shabbat Chassad is like lecture notes relative to Torah Shabbat Peh. Anyway, so there's another point, actually, by the way. The Medrash makes a point also that because Torah Shabbat Peh is or was Baal Peh, that prevented the Goyim from being able to take it over. Like this, they can take over Torah Shabbat Chassad, as historically they did, and claim it as their own. But they can't do that with Torah Shabbat Peh. It wasn't written down when they started out, and even though later on it was written down, they never took to it in the same way. So therefore, that remains uniquely ours, and therefore the Eibishter can say, like, this is our shared secret that nobody else has. Okay. Going on further, again, we were saying the Mishnayos here at the end of this parak talk about various things, various takonas that the Chacham made Mishnei Darkei Shalom in order to promote peace between people. So one of them, Piska, quotation from the Mishnah, Ma'arvin B'bayis Yoshon Mipnei Darkei Shalom. We make the Eruv we put the Eruv food, the Eruv Chatzeres food, in the old house, in the same food that it was, in the same house that it was all along, Mipnei Darkei Shalom, for reasons of peace. Like this we learned in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch not so long ago about the dinim of Eruv Chatzeres, where you have food that is owned in common by everybody from the Chatzer. Either they gather it individually from the people of the Chatzer, or one person takes a box of matzah or what have you, and is mezaka on behalf of all the people of the Chatzer. In any case, you put it in a certain house, so it should be kept from year to year, or from week to week, in that same house, and not move from one to the other, and the reason is, hey, Dr. Shalom. So the Gemara says, my timer. Why? What's wrong with moving it to another house? Even if it's covered, are you going to say, because not the covered dick for the Balabais, that you're taking away this privilege of keeping the aid of food by him, and you're giving it to somebody else? But we see that that's not a problem. You're perfectly allowed to move things, to move important things like that from one house to another. There was this shofar. Now Rashi gives two explanations of what the shofar means. One is it means, the Gemara tells us in Masech the Shabbos, that on Erev Shabbos they would blow shofar on various times. On Erev Shabbos to tell people to close up shop and stop various kinds of work. One shofar blast would tell the farmers to stop working, another one would tell the storekeepers to close their stores, etc. Like we have nowadays the siren. Motzei Shabbos also they would blow shofar to tell people Shabbos is over and you can go and you can resume your weekday activities. This shofar, as the Gemara was going to say, was taken from one Rav's house, from one Rosh Hashiva's house to another. The second explanation, Rashi says, he brings from Rav Shura Goin, that the shofar over here actually means a pushka. In Gemara terminology, we call a pushka a shofar because it's like a shofar. It's narrow on top and wide on the bottom. That way you can put in, maybe they actually had them shaped like shofars in those days. It was made that way. You could easily put in money, but you can't easily take it out. So then, according to that, the explanation would be that it was a pushka that they used to collect donations for the yeshiva. So the Gemara says, to have him the Ikra Beir of Yehuda, originally that shofar, however we define it, was located in Rav Yehuda's house. All of a Soif Beir Rabba, then after that it was in Rabba's house, all of a Soif Beir Rav Yosef, then in Rav Yosef's house, all of a Soif Beir Abaya, then in Abaya's house, all of a Soif Beir Rava, and then it was next in Rava's house. So now, according to the explanation that it was the shofar, then it means that each time that shofar would be located in the current Rosh Hashiva's house. Tosfos actually wonders about, because in that case, if we are talking about, according to the first explanation, a shofar to announce when Shabbos is beginning, what's that doing on the roof of the Rosh Hashiva's house anyway? What's that doing in the Rosh Hashiva's house? That would be the Chazan HaKnesses. The Shamash would go up onto the roof of a tall building there in town and blow it, and then the pastor, he would keep it by himself. Plus, some of these Chachamim were Rosh Hashiva in different places. The first few, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabba, Rabbi Yosef, and Abaya, were all Rosh Yeshiva in Pumbedisa, but Rava lives in a different city, Mechuza. So rather, therefore, Tosfos prefers the second explanation, that it means that it was a pushka to raise money for the yeshiva. So in that case, wherever the central yeshiva was, they would have that pushka in the Rosh Yeshiva's house. So we see whether it means a shofar or whether it means a pushka. Either way, there's no problem moving it to one from one house to another, and it's not considered a lack of covered. So Ella, no, the reason why with the Eruv Chatzeres food is Mishum Chashta, because of suspicion. So what does that mean? So there's a few explanations. Rashi says... What about Mukta? No, we're talking about the Mishnah had said that the Eruv Chatzeres food, if you have a certain person's house in the Chatzer, where every week that food is put there, then you should continue to put it there and don't move it to another house. So now we're saying the reason is not because of the Kavod of the Baal HaBayis, the reason is because of Chashad. And what the Chashad is, that you have a few different explanations. Okay. No, the Gemara was bringing a proof from the Shofar or the Pushka that for many years it was in Rabbi Yehuda's house, and then after Rabbi Yehuda passed away, then it was brought to Rabbah's house because he succeeded Rabbi Yehuda as a Rosh Hashanah. No, we don't mean Shabbos. No, the Gemara is bringing a proof that you can have something for many years in one place, and there's no problem moving it to another place. What? So now, what the reason is for Chashad? So Rashi explains like this. People are used to seeing that the Eruv food is in that house. If you move it to a different house, what's going to happen? The next neighbor who comes into the house and doesn't see the Eruv food over there is going to think, or not a neighbor, whatever, some person from outside the Chatzer who comes in and doesn't see the food in its usual place, he's going to think, look at that, these people of this Chatzer are carrying on Shabbos without making an Eruv Chatzer. So he's going to suspect all the people of the Chatzer of being careless with the dinim of Shabbos. Tosfos gives another reason, that the Chashad is, they're going to think, you know why we don't put it by his house anymore? People are going to jump to conclusions and say, because we're suspecting him that he's going to steal the food of the Eruv. So when it comes to the Pushta, it's a known thing. The Rosh Hashiva is going to have it in his house, and he'll give it out to his Talmidim. But when you have the Eruv food, if you move it to a different house, people are apt to say the reason they moved it is because there was concern that this guy is going to steal the food and keep it for himself. The Rambam gives a third reason as well, which is that we know the dinim, when we learned the dinim of Eruv Chatzeres and Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, we mentioned that when you're collecting the food individually from each person and making one big challah or matzah out of it, the one in whose house the Eruv food is going to be kept does not need to provide flour or dough or whatever towards the Eruv Chatzeres. So now, therefore, if you move it from his house, then he's going to suspect that they're doing that because they think he's stingy and he kept it in his house because he doesn't want to give towards the Eruv or something, and then it's going to cause arguments because he's going to say you're taking that away from me because you think that I'm stingy and I wouldn't give towards the Eruv. So for all those reasons, we have is why the Eruv food, once it's established, it stays in a certain house in the Chatzer, then you continue to keep it there. Okay. Piska, the Gemara goes on to say, another thing from the Mishnah, Oni hamenakif berosh hazayis. If a poor person is cutting off is harvesting olives from the top of a tree, from the top of an olive tree. So you have to leave pay up from olive trees, same as you do from grain and other things like that. So now you have a poor person climbs up there and reaches up or whatever and is cutting and is harvesting the olives and throwing them down onto the ground, masha tacht of gezel, then the olives that are under the tree are considered gezel, mipnei darkei shalom, again mipnei darkei shalom. The oni has not made any kind of kinyan on them because he didn't actually touch the olives themselves. There was no kinyan akbar or anything like that. He's just breaking them off or knocking them off or whatever from a distance. But nei darkei shalom, you shouldn't take them. So the Gemara says Tonim, we learn in a Braisa, im liket v'nosin v'yad, if the oni picked them with his hands and then threw them down onto the ground, hariz a gezel gomer, then it would be considered full-fledged gezel to take those olives, because then he actually made a kinyan on them by holding them and by picking them up with his hands. So the Gemara tells a case, Rav Kahana have a ka'ozel l'hutzel. Rav Kahana one time was walking to the city of Hutzel. Chazilah hu gavra to have a shoddy oifye. He saw that a certain person was throwing oifye. Rashi translates oifye as sticks. So he's throwing sticks at a tree, at a palm tree, to knock down dates that would fall on the ground. Keep in mind, a palm tree is very tall. The guy didn't want to climb, so instead he's using that to take his pay or whatever matnas aniyim it was from it. Tosfos explains differently that oifye means that in that case, Tosfos wonders, and the Gemara is going to say that if Kahana was taking some of them and taking some of the dates and eating them, why wouldn't he be concerned about darkei shalom? So rather, Tosfos explains the guy did climb up the palm tree, but what he was doing is he was cutting off branches and throwing them down. So then there happened to be some dates together with the branches, so Rav Kahana figured that the guy mainly wants the branches for firewood or what have you. He's not really interested in the dates, but then until the guy told him that he actually is. The Rashba gives a different answer. The Rashba says that the Rav Kahana thought that the guy is a goy, and in that case, then the dinim of Pnei Darkei Shalom doesn't necessarily apply there. And the guy responds back, he thinks that Rav Kahana doesn't know the halacha. Anyway, so this guy was throwing branches according to Tosfos, sticks according to Rashi, the Konatu and Tamri, and dates are falling off the tree. Also, Koman Kifachu, so Rav Kahana collected some of the dates and he was eating them. Omalei, the guy says to him, Chodima, Rebbe, look, Debe Yadai Shaditinu, I threw them down with my own hands. So therefore, so it's actually Gezel Gomer for you to take them. So again, if we say, so like the Rashba says, Rav Kahana thought the guy was a goy, so he didn't realize. Now he finds out the guy is a yid. Meanwhile, the other guy, knowing that he's a yid, of course, he thought Rav Kahana. He could see that Rav Kahana was a yid, but he thought maybe he didn't know the halacha. Omele, so Rav Kahana tells him, the astrid that Rav Yoshiata, you must be from the area where Rav Yoshia lived and taught halacha, and therefore therefore you're so expert in the dinim, because Rav Yoshia would make a point of darshining and explaining to the people of his town here in Hutzel. Rav Yoshia had been the Rav there in the generation before that, so Rav Yoshia, I know, in Hutzel over here, always made sure to darshan in public to the people the kind of practical halachas that they should know, and that's why you're familiar with it. So he said on him, this is like the passage says, the tzaddik is so olam, the tzaddik is the foundation of the world. Meaning, because Rabbi Yoshia, the tzaddik, lived over here, therefore he made it clear, even to the Parshita people, like this guy, that what the halacha is, and now that's why he's able to just say it off the bat like that. The Chassam Sofer gives an explanation that Rabbi Yoshia would tell the people, like this, if you don't pick up the fruit with your own hands, then you're gonna have, so you have those mishpat and those shalom. Now you have, technically, if he doesn't pick them up, he didn't make a kinyan on them, therefore, strict halacha would be that another person would be allowed to take them, like Rav Kahana, but it would be a lack of shalom. Meanwhile, on the and so therefore, sort of Yoshia taught the people this way they have both mishpat and shalom, this way they have both. So therefore, that's why he says on him, the tzaddik is so dolam, he's the foundation of the world, in the sense that we have, Sam Sofer explains, we have at the end of the first parak of Pirkei Avos, that the world stands, ala din vala emes vala sholem. So if they only went according to the technical din, you would have din and emes, but you wouldn't have sholem. So like this, he made sure that you have all of them together, din and emes and sholem, and that upholds the world. Okay. The Gemara continues, Tanan Abanan. So at the end, another thing of Daukei Shalom. So we just said that according to the Rashba, certain things of Daukei Shalom don't necessarily apply to the Goyim, but on the other hand, there were others that do. The Gemara says, Tanan Abanan, we learn in the Braisa, Mefarnesim Aniye Akum im Aniye Yisrael. We support the Goyish poor together with the Jewish poor. Now, does that mean together with that when only if we're giving tzedakah to the Jewish poor and there happen to be some Goyim there, then we also help them out? Or does it mean that the same way, does it mean the same way as we support Jewish poor, we also support Goyish poor, meaning not just as an auxiliary together with the Jews who are there, but even separately by themselves, different posts can talk about the ins and outs of that. The same way we visit the Goyish sick together with, or the same way as the Jewish ones, similarly, we get involved in burying the Goyish dead together with the Jewish dead. Now, together, Rashi stresses, means it doesn't mean we bury them in the same Beis HaKvaris. It just means, in other words, let's say Rashi says, you find a bunch of people together who were killed, of whom some are Jews and some are Goyim. Don't just pick out the Jewish bodies and bury them and leave the Goyish bodies unattended. Take care of them also and bring them to their own cemeteries and bury them properly. So all of that is Mfnei Daukei Shalom. Again, all of that promotes peace in the world, that they don't think that we're discriminating against them or something. There's a related concept in halacha called Eva that sometimes you have. Here you have, for example, technically, al pi din de gemara, for example, to be mechal Shabbos to save somebody's life would only apply to a yid, not to a goy. And the Gemara mentions elsewhere reasons that in those times even goyim would accept. You could tell a goy that only those who observe Shabbos, then Shabbos can be broken on their behalf, those that not. And back then that would have been acceptable. Nowadays, you try that, it would cause tremendous Eva. So the post can talk about that it caused tremendous anti-Semitism, and so therefore the posts can talk about it. Moshe has Trubus about it, others as well, that in that case then there is more of a heter, for example, for Hatzalah people to go and help on any call that they get, whether it's a yid or not. The Gemara goes on. Here is another example of Davke Shalom. Machzikin yedei akum b'shvius. If a goy is working his field in Eretz Yisrael during Shemitah, then you strengthen him. Now there's a Gemara on it that discusses over here what exactly that means. Does it mean that you actually help him out? The Gemara says you can't do that. You yourself, a yid, can't work the land during Shemitah. So the Gemara ends up saying that it means that just that you encourage him. You're good for you, or way to go, or whatever the equivalent expressions would have been in those times to tell him, like, be strong, do good work, or whatever. So that you can do. Have a loyal day yourself, but not if a yid is working his land during Shemitah, then you can't even encourage him verbally. We greet the goyim. We say shalom to them all the time. This means not just doing shmita any time. Even though Rashi points out shalom is a name of Hashem, so in effect you're taking a name of Hashem and using it on a goy. Nevertheless, that's fine. Mipnei davke shalom, again, in order to promote peace. So the Gemara says now how certain chachamim had their own ways of doing that. The problem was that the problem is like this. The Gemara establishes that even though you can say shalom to a goy, you shouldn't say twice shalom to him. The minhag was in those times that one, nowadays, let's say you have one person says shalom aleichem, the other one says aleichem shalom. Back then, the way that they often did it was you would say to somebody shalom and he would answer back shalom shalom. So now the Gemara says that you shouldn't do to a goy, because there's no reason to use a double name of shalom on him. One thing is as the Gemara is going to point out in a minute, especially to a Talmud Chacham, it's appropriate to say shalom to him twice, because a Talmud Chacham makes shalom but pamali shamaylo pamali shamata in Shemayim and on earth, but to a goy that's not so appropriate. So how would some of the Chachamim avoid that? Rav Chista makdim v'yov lohu shlomo. Rav Chista would proactively, when he saw a goy, he would say to him shalom. So that way, because otherwise, if a goy greets him with shalom or whatever the Aramaic equivalent is, shlomo, then Rav Chista would, out of politeness, would have to reply with a double greeting, and he didn't want to. So therefore, instead he would say shalom first, and that way he avoids that problem. Rav Kahana omale shlomo lamar. Rav Kahana, when he would see a goy, he would say to him, peace to the master. Now, what does he mean by that? So Rashi says when he says the master, he doesn't mean the goy, he means in his mind, he means his rebbe. Tosfos actually wonders, though, how is that? There's a concept called gnevas das, stealing somebody's mind, tricking somebody to make him think that you mean something when really you mean something else, and you're not allowed to do that to a goy either. So there is a different answer that some of the mafoshim say, that the vote would be rather that he would say, when he says shlom alamayu, he does in fact mean the goy, but fine, that avoids the problem of having to say twice shalom, because they would like that as much as saying twice shalom. Instead, it was considered equally polite and acceptable. Instead of saying twice shalom, it was considered equally fine to say to him a compliment like that, like shlom alamayu, and therefore that also avoids the issue of saying shalom twice. So my show refers over here to a pirush over here of his on brachas, where he explains this matter of saying shalom twice. That again, a yid has an olam hazeh and an olam haba. A yid has a guf and a nefesh elikis. A goy doesn't, and therefore there's reasons to be saying twice shalom to a yid that don't apply to them. So the Gemara tells the story. Rav Huna and Rav Chista have a yasri. Rav Huna and Rav Chista one time were sitting together. Cholif v'ozo Gniva. And Gniva passed by. We had a couple of times already in the Masechta. Gniva was a Talmud of Rav. He was a Talmud Chacham, but he was also a very argumentative person. We had a few weeks back where he was causing a lot of tzaris to Ma'ukva. So here he comes again. Cholif v'ozo Gniva. And Gniva passed by in front of them. One of them says to the other, let's get up in his honor because he's a Talmud Chacham. We had, by the way, almost the identical thing back on earlier in the Masechta as well, at the end of the third parak on Daf Lamed Aleph. We had it a couple of weeks ago here in Ein Yaakov. Where also it was the exact same thing. These two Chachamim are sitting, and Gniva passes by, and one of them proposes to stand up in his honor, and so forth. The Maharam Shif says it was all the same story, but there the Gemara brought one part of their discussion, and here the Gemara is bringing a different part of their discussion. Anyway, Omalei, the other one says, when we come in Pagon Nekum, why should we stand up in front of a Baal Machlokas? If he's like that, if he's going to be starting fights with Ma'ukva and harassing him, then he doesn't deserve the honor that a Talmud Chacham should get. Well, Adahochi, as they were talking, Osel Ihu Legabayu, Gniva came over to them. So this one, they didn't stand up in his honor, but instead he saw them and he came over to them. Omalahu, he said to them, Shlama Aleichu Malchi, Shlama Aleichu Malchi. He says, peace to you, kings, peace to you, kings. So now we have two odd things he's saying over here, that he's calling them kings, and that he's saying Shlom, and that he's saying Shalom twice. So Omrulay, so they asked him, Menolach Rabbanan Ikri Malchi, where do you get that the Chachamim are called kings, that you're greeting us and saluting us as kings? He says, Dichtib, because the Pasuk says about the Torah, Be Malachim Yimloichu Vagemer, through me, through the Torah, kings rule. So therefore, yes, the Talmud Chachamim can be called kings. And there's a lot of different explanations why that's so. They rule over, the Chachamim, in fact, they rule over reality just as a king rules over his kingdom. There's a concept, for example, the Gemara mentions, Lakeo Goymer alive, that Hashem arranges things in the Beis Din Shamayla, and even as far as nature, according to the way the Chachamim paskin. So that's one reason why they're kings. There's the Talmud Chachamim control themselves, control their midas, like a king controls his people. And there's many, many other different explanations. What exactly is, what's the connection, why the Chachamim are called kings. So that's what it is. Therefore, he says that you're considered kings. So here, Marsha also points out that, yeah, you have this concept that the Talmud Chacham makes Shalom b'Pamalya Shamayla or B'Pamalya Shamata. He makes peace in the upper and lower spheres. So then the Gemara is going to bring a pasuk involving David, where we see, in other words, that a king has that special quality of the double shalom. So they tell him, Umenolach to Taflin and Shalom Lamalchi. How do we know that you say twice Shalom to a king? Omulahu, so he answers them, the Omer of Yehuda Omerad, Minayin Shekoflin Shalom Lamalach. How do we know that we repeat Shalom when we're speaking to a king? And in fact, we have in the Agadta with the Churban, when we had Rabbi Yechim and Zakkai coming in front of Aspasionis. He also said to him, Shalom twice, even though we said you don't usually say Shalom twice to a goy, but a king is different. So how do we know? Shenema, the Pasuk says, we say this in V'yitn Lacha, V'ruach Lov Shas Amosai Rosh HaSholishim, a spirit of Ruach HaKodesh, enclothes Amosai, the head of the captains. The previous Pesukim are describing, this is during the time when David was still hiding out from Shaul. He's moving from place to place all the time. Then at some point, a contingent of warriors, including some people from Shevet Binyamin and led by someone named Amosai, come to see David. So David says, are you coming to join my forces and to help me out? Or are you coming because you're going to spy out where I am and go report to Shaul? So then the pasuk continues that Amosai was enclosed with the spirit of Ruach HaKodesh, and he says, L'cha David, we are for you, David, V'imcha ben Yishai, and we are with you, son of Yishai, Shalom, Shalom l'cha, peace, peace to you. And he continues, as we say, in V'yit l'cha v'shalom l'azrecha, and peace to your assistants, ki azorcha l'kecha, because Hashem has helped you. And sure enough, v'yitablam David, v'yitim b'rosh ha'agdud, and David appointed them officers over his little band of soldiers that he had over there. So we see that we say Shalom twice to the king, like he says Shalom, Shalom, Lecha. Marsha also adds that you have like this. So you have, when he's speaking to David, he's saying twice Shalom. When he says Lo Izrecha, to your assistants, to the people of your band, there I'm not saying Shalom twice, because after all, they're not kings. And he continues, Ki Azorcha Elekecha, you're asking, Im Bosem Elayla Ozreini, are you coming to help me, or are you coming to betray me to Shaul? So we're telling you, you don't really need our help, says Amosai. Really, Azorcha Elekecha, Hashem is helping you. We're just his shluchim. The reason we say it in V'yitn Lecha, by the way, is because we're saying several psukim that mention the concept of shalom, and this is one of them. Then they said to Gniva, Lita Mar Midi, Rebbe, would you like to eat something? Would you like to taste something? Omer Lahui answers them, no. Hochi Omer Rav Yehuda, Omer Rav, Osa Loi La'odim Shiyitem Klum, Ad Shiyitem Michael Behemte. A person is not allowed to taste anything till he gives food to his animal. Now, what's an animal doing there? Ion Yaakov suggests that maybe actually he was riding on an animal. He also says, by the way, when we said before that they were arguing among themselves whether to stand up for him, and then in the end we said that they were thinking that not because of the Baal Machlokas, so maybe actually he himself realized that they don't want to stand in front of him, which is why he went over to them and said Shalom to them to show, like, I don't hold it against you that you're not standing up for me. I forgot to mention also, as far as the matter of saying Shalom to them, as far as calling them Malachim, Ben Yehoyada says a vote on it. He says by calling them Malachim, he meant to maybe also excuse himself for the fact that they're calling him a Baal Machloikas, and he knew, even if they didn't say it to his face, he knew that he was one. But he says, you know what, the same way as kings all the time. You have kings never know much in the way of peace. They're always looking, they're always spoiling for fights and wars and everything. So the same way, you know, fine, if I'm a Baal Machloikas, okay, but I'm a Tamad Chacham, I'm a king, and therefore it's sort of to be expected of me. Anyway, so he says, so again, Ion Yaakov also suggests that he was riding on an animal, and that's why he mentions that he has to feed his animal first. So you're not allowed to eat anything before you give your animal. Shenema, as the Pesuk says, v'nasati esed b'sar chalav amtecha, Hashem says, I'll give grass for you animals in the field, v'hodu, and only that, v'ochalta v'sabata, you will eat and be satisfied, so you have to feed your animals first. The Magen Avraham, by the way, brings in Shulchan Aruch, that does not apply to drinking. When it comes to drinking, you drink first before your animals, as we see that Eliezer, that as we see that Rivka watered, first gave Eliezer water to drink, and only after that she watered his camels. A couple of reasons are given why it is. First of all, I mean, there was the matter of Tzav Alechayim, but there was one interesting pshetel that's given why that should be. The Gemara mentions that sometimes you have a place where the people themselves are not of the caliber. They're not zoicha that Hashem should provide rain and Hashem should provide sustenance for them. But because there are animals over there who they didn't do anything wrong, so therefore the Eibishter provides rain in their schos, and therefore the people get it almost as like a byproduct. So therefore, a person should first feed his animals, in case, you never know, maybe his animals are more zeichet to the food than he is. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGola, Hey Nissen. The Pasuk says, as we quote in the Haggadah, by Murderous Chayim, the Egyptians embittered the Jews' lives by avoid of kosher with hard labor, b'choymer v'lovenim, with mortar and with bricks, and everything asher ogdu v'hem b'farech, that they made them work very rigorously and hard. Now, the Zohar gives an explanation on that, that by Murderous Chayim, first of all, Chayim refers to the Torah, ki hu chayenu. The avoda kosher, the Zohar says avoda kosher zu kushia. This refers to the hard work of kashis in Torah. B'choymer is kavachomer. The Zohar says is kavachomer. Over the Zohar also mentions the Lovanim is libun hilchasa, is clarifying and clarifying out the halacha. And over chol avoda basada, the Zohar says refers to brisis. So in other words, the Zohar is explaining that all that the work in Mitzrayim on a deeper level is the hard work of teasing out and figuring out the details of Torah. So the Rebbe points out in the Sicha, you see from that it is possible to transform and to switch out all of the difficulties of Golos, all the difficulties of Parnasa, and all the harassment and everything else. They can be instead swapped out for Ruchniistic things. When a person puts himself fully into Limud HaTorah, and Taka works hard on it, and works diligently on it, then that way, with that we yotze the difficulties of Golos, and with that we can be Zoicha to a personal Geula, and a Ruchniistic Geula, which then in turn will bring the Klaudiistic and the Gashmiistic Geula. Okay. Continuing on the halachas of Eruv Tchumen. So we, all this time we've been talking about an Eruv Tchumen, but really an Eruv Tchumen should only be made for a Dvar Mitzvah. So say, for example, a person needs to go to another place to help make a minyan or to greet. It doesn't have to be an actual full-fledged mitzvah. It can be to go and greet a friend, which is a matter of Avos Yisrael, or a Rebbe or a friend who just came from a trip, or a Sudas Mitzvah, or to look out for something that's necessary for the Rabbim, or a person who wants to go home after having walked a long distance or whatever. Now, it's supposed to be made only for a Dvar Mitzvah. B'dieved, a person makes it for Dvar HaRishus, for something that's not in those categories, it still is a valid Eruv Tchumen. Another din, you can't put down an Eruv Tchumen on Shabbos or Yom Tov itself. So if Yom Tov is on Friday and you want to go on Shabbos, then you have to put it down Erev Yom Tov in the same way, like we're going to have the first day is Pesach. Or Sunday and Monday, if you wanted to make an Eruv Tchumen for Yom Tov, you would have to put it down on Erev Shabbos. You and there are also other details that are not described over here in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. There is, but are described in the big Shulchan Aruch. Those relevant simonim actually are missing in the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch. You'd have to look in the Mechaber or in Mishnah Berurah or whatever. But you have dinim of called ma'ariv beraglav, for example, that instead of putting down food like we talked about all this time, a person can actually walk to the location that he wants to be his home base for Shabbos, and he stays there. He stays there the entire Bein HaShemoshes, and then that becomes his home base without putting down food. But then you have it gets a little more complicated if you want to do it for a 2-day Yom Tov, and you have all kinds of other detailed dinim like that, which if a person has need for that, then you look up and then you look up the relevant dinim in the big Shulchan Aruch about that.